Please go ahead, Ms. Best.
Thanks. Hi there.
Hi.
It's Sharon Hammond right now. I don't know if Jack Boomer's on the line. I'm just going to go over a quick roll call. This is the Clean Air Coalition Knowledge Exchange meeting, just to make sure everybody's on the right call. So could people just call out who they are, and I'll just check you off. Hello?
Catherine Laird.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Kristen Tomlinson.
Sorry? Okay. Hello?
Leah Howard Cope.
Hi.
Hi.
Frankie Best.
Hi, Frankie.
Good morning.
Come on, it's you. Who else?
Suzanne Gaby.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
Don't be shy. I'm hanging up now. Did I scare you off? Did somebody else come on the line?
Hello, Louise Poole is here.
Hi, Louise.
Hi.
Roll call.
Russ and Eric from beautiful downtown Vernon, BC.
Oh, really? Great.
Okay. Hello.
Scott? Hello. Anybody else on the line?
Oh, hi. It's Liz Cameron from VHA.
Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Amy Graham from St. Paul's.
Hi, Amy. Anybody else? Well, you know what? Probably some people will be coming on. What I'm going to do is I'm going to hand it over to Joy and Sid. Everybody was sent their bio. As usual, it's, the Clean Air Coalition, which is the Heart and Stroke Foundation and the BC Lung Association, put these on every month. And, of course, we get the great support from the Ministry of Health and Health Canada. And so, and we're all here to listen to Joy Johnson do and talk about the priorities around tobacco within the mental health community. So they'll speak for about 20, 25 minutes, and then we'll have some room at the end, about 10 minutes, for questions if anybody has any questions. Okay? So I'll just pass it on to you, Joy.
Great. I want to, first of all, welcome everyone in the room. It's really great to see everyone, and it's nice to have people present. So thank you very much. And also want to welcome those of you in cyberspace, wearing your jammies, sipping coffee. It's great to have you with us as well. It actually is terrific to have people from throughout the province join this talk today. My name, as you know, is Joy Johnson, and I'm going to be talking about a project Sid and I are going to present together. Sid Mulchey is the project coordinator for what has been referred to as the Cactus Project. And this project has been really in different stages of development for almost 6-7 years, and we are continuing to work in partnership with Vancouver Coastal Health. And have moved into a different phase of this project, and that's what we're going to be talking to you about today. But I'm going to begin with a bit of background, and I know we've got a very educated group in the room and on the line, so I'm not going to spend a lot of detail, go through a lot of detail, but just to kind of refresh our understanding related to tobacco use and mental illness. The title of our slide is of our presentation is Unstacking the Deck, Shaping Priorities Around Tobacco Within the Mental Health Community. And I think what you'll learn from our presentation today is that creating a sense of what these priorities are is needs to be a much more iterative process than we initially anticipated. I'm going to move on to the next slide, and I'll be letting you know when I'm moving from slide to slide, just so you can stay with us. So basically, as an overview, I'm going to just give a little bit of background, as I mentioned. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the obstacles that we've experienced in terms of moving forward on this issue, describe what those are, and then we're going to talk specifically about a knowledge to action project that we're engaging in, fondly known as Cactus 2. Hopefully I'm not going to be here in 20 years' time talking about Cactus 59. Hopefully we will make progress, but we are right now in a second phase of this project. So just by way of background, you know, the people with severe mental illness, we do know that they smoke in at very high rates. They're an at-risk group that needs particular attention. And it's interesting, I don't need to go through all the details with this group, but we know that there are physiological reasons why people need nicotine to help manage their symptoms. And we also know that tar has a very important effect in terms of modifying and affecting their antipsychotic medication. And so it's a very complex issue in terms of, a particularly complex issue because of these additional factors that we need to be paying attention to. The other thing is that there are, I think, increasingly devastating consequences of tobacco addiction in the mental health community. I think there's an increasing stigma, not only from the mental illness itself, but from smoking now. And so it's an issue we need to be paying attention to in terms of thinking about how we can really focus attention and develop interventions that are going to meet the needs of individuals with severe mental illness. We tend to see lower quit levels among this population for a variety of reasons, but we know they haven't tended to get the support that they need. And to date, although this is changing rapidly, it's interesting, when we started this work 6-7 years ago, there's hardly anything happening in the tobacco mental illness field, and now it's starting to explode. We're seeing a lot more happening. So that's really encouraging, but I think a lot more needs to happen. And the other thing that, in terms of background, is that we have these evolving tobacco control policies. And it's interesting, we were talking before we started the conversation, the presentation today, about the smoke-free policies that are being enacted throughout the province at the present time. These are changing the context right now, changing the context of mental health provision. And there's a lot of discussion. When I talk with people at Vancouver Coastal Health, you know, they're struggling with what to do with these bylaws and how to make them, how to respect them, but also deal with some of the unintended consequences related to these bylaws related to smoke-free spaces. So I think that's the other piece of the context that we need to be bearing in mind. So, and the other part of this, especially, I just flashing up. Sorry, I haven't been keeping you up with me. I'm on to a slide that says Vancouver Coastal Health at the top of the slide. It's interesting because even around the draft bylaws related to smoke-free premises policy at Vancouver Coastal Health, we did see specifically mental health and addiction services highlighted as a potential area that might need special consideration. And I think that's the thin edge of the wedge here, is that once you start to indicate that special consideration is going to be required, there's a lot of debate and dialogue about what those considerations should be. And we're certainly, in our work with Vancouver Coastal, having ongoing discussions about those special considerations and whether they should be in place, whether they shouldn't, what should be happening, et cetera. So I think that's also an important piece of the context at the present time. So basically, Cactus One involved a survey of both mental health providers and clients of the Vancouver Coastal Mental Health System. And these are clients who receive mental health services from one of the Vancouver mental health teams. So they're outpatients, they're living in the community, getting support from one of these teams. And we surveyed about 780 clients of the mental health system who were attending or were receiving services from one of these teams. And just, again, I presented these findings at previous meetings, Clean Air Coalition meetings, but basically, we found that about 50% of the clients that we surveyed were current smokers. And that's interesting. It's slightly lower than is often reported in the literature in relation to mental illness, but we found a 50% tobacco use rate. We the Fagerstrom scores were very high levels of, among those who smoke, very high levels of nicotine dependence. The other thing that was very clear is that the smokers that we surveyed were reporting a number of health effects already in terms of chronic cough, other types of health issues. and so they were already being impacted by their own tobacco use. And the other thing that we have good data on is related to the economic impact of tobacco use, and that impact is severe. So people basically were giving up things like food and any other other basics in order to purchase tobacco. And when they couldn't purchase it, we had a large number of people who were getting tobacco from other sources by picking up butts and re-rolling, by borrowing, et cetera. And so a lot of high-risk behavior happening around their tobacco use, putting them at risk as well. And so I think it also makes a very compelling case for why we need to be focusing on this. Not just about, you know, encouraging people to quit for their health, but there's also all of these other stigmatizing and economic factors that come into play. And it's interesting, most of the smokers indicated to us that they did not feel they had the supports from the mental health system to help them quit. So a lot of them indicated they wanted to quit, but indicated that they didn't feel they had the support to do so. So that was the client side of the data. We also, I'm turning to a next slide that says Practice 1 provider findings. And we also surveyed the providers. And these are both, these are people working in the mental health system providing frontline services in both at the mental health, at the mental health teams. But also in some of the other contracted facilities. And one thing that really stuck out, these are kind of, again, some key findings. Everybody that we surveyed tended to indicate that they thought it was important to provide support related to tobacco cessation. Nobody thought it was their role. Everybody thought it was somebody else's role to do so. You know, the physicians thought it was the nurses thought it was the, you know, OTs, the OTs thought it was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. No one really believed and indicated to us that they thought it was an essential part of their role. The other thing that we found was that there was really a lack of knowledge and confidence. People indicated that they actually didn't know what to do. They felt they didn't have enough training. They didn't know how to support someone with mental illness to quit smoking. Another finding that I think is important is that many of the people that we spoke with or surveyed basically indicated that they were being exposed to secondhand smoke on a regular basis in clients' homes, as they walked with clients, actually in workplaces, et cetera. That's changing now, obviously, but there was a high level of exposure, and many people were concerned about that. There was confusion related to the messaging for clients, and I think this has been an area that we need to work on a lot more to reduce or to quit, to reduce or to quit. What should we be telling clients? What's best? You know, or once you indicate, you know, even reducing, are you, you know, kind of giving up the message around cessation, and how should we be handling all of these things? And then finally, I guess another point that was very salient was this cultural currency related to tobacco. We found that providers are still buying cigarettes out of petty cash, providing cigarettes as incentives for people to do certain kinds of things. It's definitely part of the system, remains part of the system. And the other element, we asked specific questions about whether you thought it helped you basically in your relationship with your client if you smoke together. And we did see about a 20% tobacco use rate among the providers, so that's higher than the Vancouver rate, certainly. And many of them thought it's absolutely appropriate to continue to smoke with clients and that there was kind of bonding therapeutic value. So that was a part of the picture as well. So basically, that was kind of the background that kind of set us up for the next phase of the project. Okay, so we've got this information. We have a set of best practices. But what are we going to do? How are we going to start to change the system? And that's a real question that we all have. And I think that in order to, you know, begin to grapple with that, I think we have to understand why there is a no-do gap. We know a lot of things, but we're not doing a lot of things in relation to this. And I think we have to bear this in mind. And if you talk to people working in the mental health system, these are some of the things that you would hear about, that they have a busy and overloaded caseload, can't take one more thing on, can't do another thing. They're so busy, things are changing, they're just being asked to do so many things. As I mentioned already, the embeddedness of tobacco. It's so much part of the system, it's very hard for people to think about how it could be different. there's another very strong assumption about the autonomy of clients, that they are, that providers actually shouldn't actually have to raise the issue or engage with their clients because they can, quote-unquote, decide for themselves. And because of that, they don't necessarily need support. And it actually would be judgmental to raise the issue with a client because they might feel that you're making a judgment about their tobacco use, et cetera. So there's those types of values at play as well. I think the other thing, and I think this is changing, but in mental health, whereas in certain kinds of settings, like if you work in a cardiac setting, for example, there's a real culture around moving best practices into practice. And that hasn't been necessarily part of the culture of psychiatric care. And I think in part that's because it's a very autonomous type of practice that people engage in. They kind of develop their own personal style about how they want to work with clients. And this idea of incorporating best practices hasn't always been part of the culture of psychiatric services. The other problem is that many providers see the mandate of mental health programming focusing on mental health. They talk about holistic health, but they don't actually see tobacco as a mental health issue. So it kind of moves down the list of priorities. And I think the other issue related to the no-do gap is that we haven't really, I think in terms of our best practices, taken the specific needs of the mental health community into account. And so while we do have best practices specifically related to smoking cessation, I think that what we haven't done is really develop and tailor those interventions and best practices to the unique needs of those in the mental health community. So there's some work to be done in that area. So basically, out of this kind of background, Cactus II, a project funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, was born. And as I mentioned, this is a Knowledge to Action project, and I'm going to pass it over to Sid, my counterpart, to talk about Cactus II a little bit, and then we'll have some questions.
Okay, so as John mentioned, this is a partnership between Vancouver Coastal Health, BC Mental Health and Addictions Network, and UBC. And this is a knowledge translation project, so we really wanted to look at how our research knowledge that we have done with Cactus One could be translated into clinical practice to make it for people in their everyday work in mental health.
Would you mind just speaking up a bit?
Oh, this is Ben. Yeah. Actually, there's two here.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So we're on the slide that says knowledge to action, and these are these were the objectives that we had when we wrote this grant. So we wanted to design and implement integrated clinical tobacco reduction interventions to determine factors that influence the effect of knowledge translation and evaluate the uptake and the implementation of best practice recommendations. And so next slide.
Yeah.
So these are some of the things that we initially thought would be feasible things to do within this context. So providing training and materials, programs and services, developing protocols and guidelines. And some of these things we're continuing to push forward. So, for example, there is a smoking cessation group called the Butt Out Program, and we're hoping to strengthen and expand that existing program. And we are in the process of creating some assessments and some protocols around off-label use and that kind of thing. But we found quite quickly that this was a very top-down approach. We had gone in thinking we were going to just be able to sort of train people up, implement these things in a very A plus B kind of way. And what we realized that was really inappropriate. We really needed to start from the bottom and go up. So initially when we had written the grant, we talked about targeting the whole mental health system, and we quickly realized that was a very lofty goal. We needed to pare down and focus on some really specific sites that we could work with and learn from. And so we're moving on to the next slide that says case studies. And so what we decided to do, and we were working here again with Vancouver Coastal Health, so they recommended certain sites to us, and we handpicked some of these as well. We've decided to focus on six sites within mental health. So we have the two community mental health teams, two drop-in centers or community resource centers, and two housing units. And we deliberately were working, I've actually realize that for our first cactus project, I can't believe that we have gone into some of these places without the process of working very, very closely with the Vancouver Social Health Managers, because they've been very instrumental in this project in helping us negotiate access to places and helping us to create the buy-in from the Vancouver Coastal Health Manager to the site manager all the way to the staff. And we've chosen deliberately six sites that are spread out among different organizations so that each of the sites can serve as sort of a starting template for a place where we can implement some kind of strategy that will be unique to that workplace culture, their mandate, their organization, and their specific context. And so we're on the next slide that says action research, and we're using this cyclical process of plan, do, study, act. And so what we're doing is we're going into each one of these sites, and we wanted to do a needs assessment with each site to be able to figure out, instead of us deciding, okay, this is what needs to happen, and we're going to implement this, we wanted to work with each staff and try to interview them and see, you know, where they feel their strengths are, where they feel their knowledge gaps are, what they think would bolster their practices around tobacco cessation, what would work, what would work with the experiences of the staff and the clients in that workplace. So this takes on a different kind of very grassroots approach. And so we're going into each site and doing interviews, and this is serving as our baseline data. We'll do interviews at the end as well, but this piece is really about collaboration. So we're going in talking to all the staff, and then we're going to present it back to them to let them know where they're at collectively as a group around the tobacco issue, and then from there start to figure out, as that being the starting point, figure out how to build and shift the culture and shift the priority. So we want to work with them to find services, to be able to provide services and resources that are unique and relevant to their organizational readiness, so to speak.
That's our nice little graphic there.
I like the animation. So we're on the slide that says knowledge exchange, and this is the Canadian Institutes of Health Research Knowledge to Action model for knowledge translation. So I'm just going to walk you through this a little bit. The inner circle represents one of the cycles. So the inner circle is a knowledge creation funnel. It's made up of the things you can see here, knowledge inquiry, knowledge synthesis, and knowledge tools. And then the outer cycle is the action cycle. And so this is the, Joy spoke before about the no-do gap. So this is sort of in a general kind of way presented as a solution to that gap. And so the action cycle at the bottom here, you can see it identifies a problem, and then you adapt the knowledge about that problem to the local context, that's barriers to knowledge, and then moving up, select, tailor, and implement these interventions, monitor knowledge use, evaluate outcomes, and sustain knowledge. And again, this seems like a very A plus B plus C plus C kind of model that seems actually quite easy in some ways. And what we're finding is the model doesn't go quite far enough for our purposes. It's sort of inappropriate for our purposes in sort of two major ways. One is that it's a deficit model. So it takes a problem and says that there's a problem that needs to be fixed, and somebody needs to go in and fix it. So that's one issue that we have with it. And the other is that it tells us in these boxes, you know, it tells us these are sort of things that we need to do, but it doesn't tell us how to do that. So we don't really have a roadmap, and I think that several different contexts about tobacco, around tobacco, have this issue of the how-to, and we sort of, we are struggling with how to do this knowledge exchange. And so moving on to the next slide, what we've been talking about is supplementing this theory and this framework with two additional frameworks that are really helping us to guide how we do the research and our philosophy of how our research plays out in the context of the mental health community. So the first piece here is motivational interviewing, and this isn't really a new theory or technique to the mental health system. This is a theory that grew out of individual behavior change. It's already been incorporated incorporated somewhat into the provider's practices. And so just some of the basic principles are things like expressing empathy for clients, developing discrepancy around clients' behavior change and what their values are, rolling with resistance, so seeing that ambivalence is a normal thing and sort of working with it, and supporting people's self-efficacy. And so we're understanding this on an individual level when we talk to people, but also on sort of an organizational level around tobacco. So some of the ways that we think about this and some of the ways that it plays out in the research setting are things like when we're going and doing these needs assessment and we have sets of questions that we're asking and people feel the need to tell their story. So you'll have somebody talking about a relative who died of lung cancer, and in that way we will be expressing empathy for their experience around that. And then even through the process of engaging in these needs assessment pieces, we actually find that that process, that research process, is a process of developing discrepancy between people's behaviors, what their practices are around tobacco cessation with their clients, and what their values are around these issues. So we're developing discrepancy there. And then a big piece for us is sort of framing organizational pushback around tobacco policies in this idea of rolling with resistance, and that's how we understand the organizational resistance that might be present within the context. And so, you know, some of the things that we're doing is we're asking ourselves, what stage of change and what level of readiness are individuals at these work sites at, and also what level of readiness are the work sites at, and how can we tailor what strategies we decide to implement to those specific pieces. And then just quickly I'll touch upon appreciative inquiry, same slide. And this is a theory talking about the social innovation potential of a system. So it talks about discovering what the best is of what already exists in an organization and how to increase the experience of the best of what could be. And so the theory talks about organizations move in the direction of the questions that are asked. And so before we were talking about, you know, looking for problems and fixing them and that deficit model, that takes you in the direction of the problem, whereas we want to come not out of crisis but out of possibility. So we want to ask the questions differently. And that theory resonates with our idea of coming out of strength. And the idea that change can not only be transitional but transformational. So that's how we see the shifting process. The theory also talks about how change happens over conversations, and the conversations that people have construct their reality. And so, for example, with our needs assessments, we're helping to change the conversation and helping to construct a new reality around tobacco that's happening in the workplace. So what we're really doing is asking people, what do you think is possible? What do you want more of? And the theory suggests that you have to find what already exists and fan it, so make more of those things that already exist. So our next slide here is for take-home messages. So we know that we've learned that it's less useful to have a one-way knowledge transfer, and we need to create space for people, the people who are most impacted by the knowledge, to dialogue and reflect about the knowledge. So that's really essential for knowledge exchange. We've also recognized that it's important to focus less on deficits in a system and more useful to build on strengths and appreciate what's already present in the system. We know that change takes time. So as Joy mentioned, we've been doing this work for 6 or 7 years, and we know that work around tobacco takes a long time. And so we expect that things are going to move slowly. Instead of sort of plowing through the system that we're not actually a part of, what we need to do is support the evolution of new cultural norms related to tobacco and mental health.
Great. So it's interesting. Part of the reason we wanted to talk about this today is I'm hearing a lot about some of the resistance that's happening in organizations, mental health organizations right now. And I think that this idea of rolling with resistance is something that might be very useful for us to be thinking about. What is the source of that resistance? And rather than just keeping pushing, we might need to just try to start to think about these issues in a very different way. And I think some of those frameworks, both the motivational interviewing framework and those principles, although developed for individuals, can be applied to organizations, and I think it's worthwhile thinking about that. And also this notion of working from strength, and because the other thing that we've really learned is that people actually do want to change their practices. People are concerned about this issue, but you have to find a way to work from that rather than going in with an attitude that you're not doing enough, you need to do more, we need to break these barriers down all the time. So it's been a real mind shift for us, both in terms of the way we're working with these organizations and what we think might be possible, but also, I think, contributing to the whole field of knowledge exchange as well, getting us to think about this in a very different way. So some final thoughts. We've got a quote up here. We must be committed to changing the environment that people are being asked to grow in. And that's been the Cactus Project from day one. Cultivating awareness of the context of tobacco use is what Cactus was all about, because our environments shape our behavior. We really do believe in that. And so if you're going to start to change individual behavior, we need to pay attention to what's happening in environments as well. So Sid and I are going to leave it there, and I'd really love to dialogue with you around how you're working with organizations, whether this resonates for you in any way. We're in the middle of this project still. As Sid has indicated, we just started, we've almost completed the needs assessment phase, and what we're doing is we're taking this data back. We've got two individuals from the Vancouver Coastal Health who work within the system working with us to do engagement with each one of these work sites to develop a plan. We're quite excited about what the possibilities will be, but we'll let you know. We'll come back and let you know where we're at with all of this.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Joy. I don't know if, Jack, are you on the call?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm just going to put it out there to questions. I don't know if you had any questions that you wanted to ask, or if usually we just let people jump in if they've got any questions. So if somebody's got a question for Joy or Sid, please go ahead.
Well, I have a question, but I will let it others ask questions first if they'd like.
Jack, you're going to have to ask your question.
Okay, well, that's great.
We'll get us started.
There you go, exactly. So, first of all, Joy and Sid, thank you so much. I guess what I'm wondering about is, so when you're going out, have you actually, are people actually starting to say, well, what can we do? And are they, is their practice being influenced because of the work that you're doing? And when you talk about some of the case studies, I'm wondering, I'd be very interested to hear if there's been any examples of people that are have started to shift their practice as a result of the work that you're doing and being influenced by it.
Well, did you hear that question? It's about it's a little faint in here, Jack, but
okay.
The question really is about whether we're starting to see people shift their practices and what's happening. You know, the other thing about doing this research is things are already happening in Vancouver Coastal. So we know the TEACH program is going to be offered again in Vancouver Coastal. There's things happening.
Right.
And that's part of the context. It's interesting, in the initial work that we've done, and Sid probably can comment on this more than I can, my sense is that what has happened particularly within Vancouver Coastal, is that there has been a dependence developed on the Butt Out program. So this is a group program offered, a smoking cessation program, and people tend to think, well, we've got the Butt Out program, we don't need to do anything else. And so we are trying to shift that culture more than anything so that we kind of think everybody should be involved in tobacco policy and in smoking cessation intervention, just around ask, advise, assist, arrange, et cetera,
We think that ultimately is where we'd like to see things going. I think that what we've done so far is we've got people at every work site prepared to commit to doing something. So that's a shift already.
Right.
And we are developing advisory groups at every work site to talk about what might be possible. The idea, and this really came from our Vancouver Coastal Partners, is that once we develop, for example, there's no assessment form, for example, for intake of clients related to their tobacco use in the mental health system right now. So, you know, once we get some of this stuff organized and piloted at these sites, we'll be able to hopefully roll it out across the system. But we need to work out the bugs in these six cases before we start to try to do wide system change. So we actually are quite heartened that change is possible, but it is going to take a little bit of time and training. And I think we're often very restless about what is possible. We expect things to happen very quickly and people's practices to change very quickly. We're committed to be in each team for a period of about 8 months, meeting with them regularly, talking to them, focusing on training, developing materials, protocols, et cetera. And we'll see what's going to be possible. It's still very early days. Do you want to say anything else about that?
Yeah, just one extra piece about that is that just from going in and talking to people, it's interesting because smoking for some people is, I'm talking to the phone. Smoking is not on their radar at all in some cases. And so after spending, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour talking about smoking, people have, you know, I would say about 30% of the people after doing these needs assessments say, oh, this has been really good. I'm going to go talk to my clients about their smoking. I'm going to remember to do this. So the issue is that they need to keep remembering how to do it, or remembering to do it, and that's something that has come up. We need reminders. But yeah, I think that, and we have found this with the Cactus One Project, that just the process of doing research definitely brings it to people, the forefront of people's minds, and changes their practice somewhat.
And those are going to be things we'll be documenting.
And I'm also wondering, too, about the kinds of resistance. Like, is there similar resistance across the board in all the sites, or are you finding different issues coming up in different sites, or is it the same stuff coming up again and again?
It's totally different. I mean, as you can appreciate, a mental health team that's, you know, got doctors, physicians, social workers, and they see their clients for maybe 5 minutes to half an hour, have very different needs around support or training or knowledge or whatever than somebody who is working in a place where people live and spending, you know, 5 or 6 hours with a client. And so, so far I've found that all of the different sites have been completely different. So, you know, there's the issue of housing. So it's residence. So it's where people live, and it's that human rights argument of the balance of, you know, somebody should have the right to smoke where they live. So, for example, one of the sites has actually people smoke in their rooms. They're smoking allowed. They're under the special considerations. So they're smoking in the building. It's actually a very new building. It was just built 2 years ago. And the manager actually commented to me that he's very upset that they started out with it being a smoking building because it is so new. And when people come through on tours, they comment that they can't believe that they're smoking there. But anyway, so you can smoke in the background and in the front of that property. And so that's a big issue for them, whereas at a team, that's not really as relevant because they aren't having people, people are respecting the bylaw there, and so that's not really an issue. But then there are other issues, you know, like how to manage their client. If somebody doesn't want to quit smoking, let's say, how to manage smoke-free management if they're walking to appointments with people, or if they're taking somebody to a job interview, how to manage those kind of things.
Yeah, the other issue, of course, is the drop-ins. There was a lot of concern about the drop-ins when the smoke-free policy was established, that people would come to the drop-ins less. There were issues also about the clients actually obeying the 6 meter rule, but then going and smoking in front of the businesses in other places, and so it's created a lot of difficult. So there have been kind of, I guess, issues in each one of these sites. And the reason we also chose these sites is we think that the locus of action can't just be because people with mental illness live, work, engage in all these different sites, it's not going to be enough just to focus on the mental health teams. We think that we need intervention and support located in all of these places. And I think that's also what changes the dynamic of what we need to do. So we're talking also about training people who aren't necessarily healthcare providers, are trained as healthcare providers, to also provide support. Does anybody else have any questions?
I do, Sharon. It's Frankie.
Hi, Frankie.
Hi. Joy, first of all, really exciting project. I'm interested in the timelines and when you will be doing the evaluation and how you're going to be evaluating, and finally, if you're going to be able to share the results of the evaluation with the BC community.
Yeah. This actually was a 2-year grant from CIHR, and we already know we're not going to quite get it done in 2 years, but we definitely are going to be evaluating, and what we're doing two things for the evaluation. One is we're in these sites on a regular basis and observing. It's kind of an ethnographic approach. We're taking field notes, observing behaviors, looking at what's happening, documenting changes in policies, protocols, those types of things. So that's number one. Number two, we have baseline interviews with all providers in these sites, and we're going to be repeating those interviews. We're not actually interviewing or engaging with the clients at all in this part of the project. We really wanted to work primarily with the providers and encourage them to work with their client groups. So this is absolutely, we're going to be writing papers, doing presentations, sharing this information with, and be happy to come back and talk about what we've learned. Hopefully we'll have a good news story. We're still very optimistic, and we will have a good news story. But the nature of this work, Plan, Do, Study, Act, is that there will be issues that arise, and I think that's part of the learning as well, is that you've just got to figure out how to adapt on the ground to some of these things and not... kind of find the workaround, find out what is possible in these sites, and move from those possibilities. So the bottom line is, I think by next May, June, we should have some preliminary results that we should be able to share about what's occurring. And we're already starting to think about Cactus Tree. What should happen next in the mental health community. I mean, it's interesting. One thing that people keep talking to us about is the acute care psychiatry, that there is so much resistance happening right now in acute care psychiatry that's another place, and that's another location where a lot of these clients end up for short periods of time, but they're currently, from what I understand, particularly in the Vancouver context, and perhaps the individuals from St. Paul could comment on this, I understand there's quite a bit of resistance happening in some of the psychiatric settings. So those are other issues that we're going to need to pay attention to.
That's great, Joy. I would really love it if you could come and do a rounds at the ministry.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, love to do that.
Excellent. Thanks.
The other
is June?
Next June, a year this June.
Sorry.
Yeah. The other thing is, and I'm just going to, sorry, I need to just mention this. One of our biggest barriers, talking about the ministry, one of our biggest barriers is the availability of NRT. Until nicotine replacement therapy is made available cost-free for these clients, we are not going to lick this problem. And I know there are work being done within the ministry right now around examining this issue, but we as a community have to push hard because we know that right now, part of the Cactus Project, we are providing NRT. We're bringing it into these sites, but this will not be sustainable. And so we've got to get our collective heads around this issue and figure out, particularly for these types of clients, how we're going to make it available. Because,
Joy?
Yeah?
This is Suzanne. And the other issue around the NRT thing is it's just not normal NRT. It's the off-labeling, which is
absolutely
a huge barrier as well.
Absolutely. So we're doing off-label protocols, trying to, you know, we got a whole sea change that needs to happen around the amount of NRT that these clients are going to require. And the other thing is it's not just a three-month course of NRT. Some of these people are going to need to be on NRT for the long term. You know, so we need to, we really do need a bit of a sea change in terms of thinking about NRT with this client group in particular.
I think that's probably a good spot to end it on just because it's getting to 8:30 and we usually have to end these calls right at 8:30. But I just want to thank you both very much for presenting today, and that was fantastic. And hopefully we'll look forward to the next presentation.
Absolutely.
One of the things that I wanted to mention, and maybe, Jackie, you want to talk about this, is that we are going to be doing a survey of our own around these meetings to find out, you know, what works, what doesn't, the format, the time of the meetings. We've had some issues around people saying these meetings are too early. So we're open to change. Do you have something to add to that, Jack?
No. Well, yes. Actually, again, this is our funding goes until the end of March. So really want to thank, again, the Ministry of Healthy Living and Sport through the support of Frankie Best and Shelley Kanitz and Simon Barton for helping fund the calls. As well, just want to let people know that the support of Health Canada through Shirley Thompson and her shop and their support, these calls have been made possible through all of that. And, you know, we will be sending out a survey, and we would ask people to take a few minutes. We'll try to do it on SurveyMonkey and make it as painless as possible. But we want to find out topics. Many of the topics this year that we selected were because of feedback from you, as well timing. You know, we're increasingly getting more and more people joining online rather than coming to the meeting place in Vancouver. And so as a result, maybe what we should do is move towards, you know, shifting the purpose of the meetings, because originally they were designed to bring people together to meet each other, in particular in the Lower Mainland, because a lot of people had heard everyone's names but didn't even know what they looked like after 5 or 10 years. So we would like your feedback on all of that. And again, if you have ideas or suggestions for speakers, or we would gladly welcome them. We'll send this, and God willing, we will get funding next year to carry these on. So thanks, everyone. And again, thanks, Joy and Sid, just to echo what Sharon said. Everyone have a great day.